Let's go on then to a chapter that's all about the specialness of water, which I was alluding to in the previous chapter. The opening slide is really review at this point, even though you just learned this moments ago. We're looking at water molecules here, and water molecules are polar because they contain covalent bonds. And what is the requirement for a covalent bond to be polar? No, nonmetal is a requirement for it to be a covalent bond. What is the requirement for that covalent bond to be polar versus nonpolar? There has to be unequal sharing of that pair of electrons by those two atoms. And why is there unequal sharing if there is? Well, close. More specifically, there has to be a pretty drastic difference in the electronegativity values for those two atoms. All right? So that means those two atoms have to be different kinds of atoms, right? For them to have different electronegativity values. Well, oxygen and hydrogen are not only different kinds of atoms, but in this specific case, they differ pretty drastically in their electronegativity values. So the sharing is unequal, and each of the two covalent bonds in a water molecule is a polar covalent bond, therefore the entire molecule is polar. And in the usual case, you don't have a single water molecule, you have trillions and trillions of them, only five of which are shown here for simplicity. But like I said, when you have polar molecules in proximity to each other, they will swivel in such a way so that their partially negative side is close to a partially positive side of the next molecule, causing a little bit of order that wouldn't exist in a population of nonpolar molecules. If you think of two oxygen molecules coming into contact, well, just think about one oxygen molecule. Is that a polar or a nonpolar compound? Or no, it's not a compound, sorry. Molecule.
Nonpolar.
Why? That's not why. You are right that it is nonpolar, but why is it nonpolar? Well, think about it this way. It's nonpolar because it's not polar. What has to be true for it to be polar that we just went over? Unequal sharing if it's polar, right? Therefore, if it's nonpolar, there has to be equal sharing. What has to be true for there to be equal sharing? Very similar, if not equal, electronegativity values. Well, if you have two oxygen atoms, they are exactly equal in their electronegativities, right? They're identical. So each one has a very high electronegativity, and each oxygen individually wants both of those shared electrons for itself. But both of them are equally greedy, so no one wins out. All right? So it's not an individual electronegativity value that matters. It's the difference, if any, between the two electronegativity values. And there is no difference in two oxygens or in two hydrogens. Yeah?
So would every molecule containing different atoms be polar?
We don't classify them necessarily as polar because sometimes you'll have two different atoms that, though they technically don't have identical electronegativity values, they're close enough so that the sharing is effectively equal. That's not true, though, for water. Water is polar. And that gives water all kinds of special properties that we'll talk about. All of these properties really, though, just spring from the fact that water is polar. And no life would exist without it. Which is why, by the way, when we look for extraterrestrial life, it really amounts to looking to see whether there's water on those places. Because without any water, we might as well stop looking. Because of all these things we're going to talk about in here that allows life to exist. Slide 2 gives you an example in a tree, or any plant. A tree is just a particularly big plant. The arrows, the blue arrows, show you the direction of water movement, as you see, which is a one-way movement. Water comes into the plant at the roots. And this is for a vascular plant, which the vast majority of plants nowadays are, ones that have vessels. So they enter vessels in the root system. I mean, water does, not they. Water molecules do. And they travel up through the body of the plant. And then they exit the plant through the leaves, which is not why they're called leaves, but that's where the water leaves the plant. And that one-way movement of water through the plant is called transpiration. Now, this is absolutely necessary to keep the plant alive because water has to be delivered to all living parts of the plant, including all those leaves at the top. This is caused inside of little vessels called xylem vessels in a plant because of polarity of water. Here you have an extreme close-up of the interior of one of these little straw-like xylem tubes. There are millions of them in the overall plant, but we're looking at just one here. And that's how the water flows upward. It goes through these tubes. But notice that water is going against gravity. It's lifting. And this is because of something called capillary attraction. You know, if you have a capillary tube, a glass capillary tube, and you lance your finger and you put the capillary tube on the drop of blood, it seems to suck the blood right up against gravity, right? Same thing is happening in the xylem tube of a plant. But why is that? How is it able to go against gravity? Gravity is trying to make it fall. So there has to be an even greater force winning out against gravity to lift it. And that greater force is the attraction between water molecules since they are polar. Wouldn't happen if they are nonpolar because they would not be attracted to each other. So you can see with the dotted lines here that there's forces of attraction between water molecules. And, well, actually there are two attractive forces here. They're really the same kind of force, but we give them two names, which are adhesion and cohesion. The difference here is that cohesion, co once again meaning share, is attraction between particles of the same type. In this case, the water molecules. Adhesion is attraction between particles of different type. Now, it's still hydrogen bonds that we're talking about in both of these cases, but adhesion is hydrogen bonding between a water molecule in the interior of the tube and the molecules making up the wall of the tube itself. They're different kinds of molecules, so that's adhesion. Cohesion is between a water molecule and another water molecule behind it. And I say behind it because this column of water molecules is very much like a train. You know, in a train, you don't have powered cars except at the front or at the very back. Most of the cars are just being dragged by the engines, right, which are producing the force. But that only works if you have all the cars hooked together, right? And they will follow the engine because they're hooked together. Well, those hitches between train cars are like the hydrogen bonds between water molecules. This is like a train of water molecules. And if the first one at the top of this figure moves upward, it's going to drag the ones behind it along for the ride because of hydrogen bonding. And what brings the top water molecule even farther up is that it is attracted to a molecule on the wall of the xylem through hydrogen bonding by adhesive force. And just like in a train, if any of these is broken, any of these hitches is broken, that's just going to leave those cars to come to a stop, right? And the rest of the train would go on. Well, that would cause a bubble, basically, a gap in the tree, and that would kill it eventually. But the impressive thing here is how strong these combined forces can be. Each individual hydrogen bond is tiny in magnitude, easy to break. But when you have trillions and trillions of them combined, it's enough to bring water to the top of the tallest organisms that have ever existed, sequoia trees. They are bigger, vertically bigger than anything that's ever existed. And depending on how you define organisms, not just vertically bigger, they're the biggest things that have ever lived. Well, I don't know whether you visited the sequoias or not, but they're tall as hell. And if you think about skyscrapers, well, before I even get to skyscrapers, just think about your own house. You're used to water coming on when you turn the spigot, right? It comes out if you've paid your bill. But why is it that it comes out? It comes out because there's higher water pressure inside than outside, so it's going to go down what we call a pressure gradient. Why is it, though, that it's pressurized to begin with? Never thought about this? Just pay the bill. The reason it's pressurized is because the water coming through your pipes to your house start out higher than your house. And gravity provides the force. You know, in plain states that don't have hills, you see water towers, which are big storage tanks higher than most buildings. And therefore, when you turn on your spigot, it's really just allowing water to come downhill. And around here, you see water towers put on top of mesas, which are higher than most houses. But if you think about a skyscraper, which is much taller than the water towers, how does water get to the top? Well, it's never going to unless you force it up there against gravity, which is why skyscrapers need their dedicated pumps to bring water to the top floor. There aren't any electrical pumps operating in a tree, and there aren't even any heart-like pumps operating in a tree. It's all of that force, which is a tremendous amount of force to get that water to the top of a sequoia, is delivered by these tiny individually tiny hydrogen bonds. And it's probable, you know, it has to win out against gravity. If it gets any taller, gravity will win out, and that will break the train apart. So it's probable that sequoias have evolved to be just about as tall as anything can be and still get water up there by hydrogen bonding. Slide 3. This animal is able to walk on water, as you see, on the surface of water. And that's remarkable because the water is liquid, and if you try this, you're going to sink, right? Well, if you look at the photograph, you can see that where each appendage is touching the water is kind of deforming as though it has a skin on it. And it doesn't just look like that. It actually does have sort of a thicker skin compared to the rest of the depth of the water. And if it didn't have that skin, then this would sink as well. This animal would sink. Well, the reason that this skin forms, like I said, it's all of these things have to do with polarity of water, is for this reason. Hopefully this will explain it. If you have a container of water molecules, there's water molecules in it by the many trillions. We'll just indicate them by dots here. For most of the depth of that sample of water, from the viewpoint of each individual water molecule in the depth, there's water molecules all around it, right? And they're all polar, so they're all slightly attracted to each other. So they're being pulled equally in all directions. But for the very surface, those water molecules are being pulled downward because there's water molecules below them, but they're not being pulled upward because there aren't any above them, right? And therefore, the very top so many molecules thickness get compressed compared to all the rest of the thickness of the water column. And that actually makes it a little bit tougher, has a higher density in that thin region compared to the water molecules at depth. And it really is like a skin. Now, it's continuously changing because the water molecules that are involved are not permanently there. But the ones that are at any given moment at the surface are compressed together compared to at depth. And this allows this animal to walk on water. Now, it's also helping, by the way, here, that its long legs are spreading out the force of its weight over a very big area. And that means the pressure gets reduced. Anyway, that's that. Well, I've said enough about that. Let's go on to slide four. Well, this map illustrates a couple things that I want to talk about. And it doesn't matter at all where this is specifically. This is just an example. It could be any coastline. But the point here is that you have a large water mass adjoining a large land mass. And that allows me to give you two definitions that are important about water. Well, they're important definitions about any substance, but we'll talk about water's values of them. One of these is specific heat capacity. Now, any given substance has some value for what we call the specific heat capacity. But the definition of specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that stuff, whatever it is, by 1 Kelvin or 1 degree centigrade, which is the same amount. So in other words, specific heat capacity is a measure of how easy or how difficult it is to heat that substance up compared to other substances. And the higher the value for specific heat capacity, the more energy it requires to get the temperature up by 1 degree, if you're talking about a gram of that stuff. Right? In other words, the higher the level of specific heat capacity, the more energy it's going to take to heat it, the harder it is to heat it. Well, compared to most substances, water has a pretty high specific heat capacity. And this is the actual science behind the old adage that a watched pot never boils, right? You're in a hurry, you want the pot of water to boil, and it seems like it takes forever because water has a high specific heat capacity. So to get it up to the boiling point for a given amount of water requires a lot more heat than it does, a lot more energy than it than the, an equal amount of some other substance would take. You know, if you have a skillet and you put two skillets, you put a tablespoon of water in one and a tablespoon of oil in the other, the one with oil is going to get hot like that if you have hot pans. But the water one, not as nearly as quickly, because water has a higher specific heat capacity. And this is explained once again because of hydrogen bonding. Water is polar, oils are nonpolar. Okay, well, think back to what I said temperature is. What is temperature? Now, I know some of you were there that day. Temperature is an indication of the average speed of particles in a sample. Right? That means the higher the temperature, the higher the average speed. Well, if you deliver energy to a sample, if you heat it up, that energy causes the particles to move, right? But in a polar sample, a sample of polar molecules, before those molecules can actually speed up, some of the energy has to go into first breaking the hydrogen bond so that they can leave. And that's why polar samples like water are harder to heat up. They have a higher specific heat capacity. Now, this is another thing that you owe your life to, because that means a large body of water, like an ocean or a lake, since it has a higher specific heat capacity than the land mass, will undergo less of a change each day in its temperature. It's harder to heat up, and it's harder to cool off. So it's obviously it gets heated during sunlight. So each day, each 24-hour cycle, it's going to go up and down a little bit, the temperature. But a land mass that's receiving the same energy from the sun, because it's right by the water, is going to undergo a higher amplitude, a bigger shift between the maximum and the minimum. It's going to get hotter in the day and colder at night. Well, we are terrestrial animals, live on land, so we tend to think that's the only thing that exists. But never lose track of the fact that life started in the ocean, and for billions of years, that's the only place there was life. It started in the ocean because the ocean, by virtue of this smaller amplitude in its range of temperatures, is due to the fact that high specific heat capacity of water buffers the change in temperature. It makes it much more stable, and therefore it was an easier thing for life to get started in a more stable environment. Now, another definition that is still applicable here is the latent heat of vaporization. Once again, this doesn't apply to just water. Any given substance has some value for the latent heat of vaporization. And the definition of that is the amount of energy required to change 1 gram of that stuff from a liquid to a gas. In other words, to evaporate 1 gram of that stuff. That's not a chemical change. That's a physical change. Because when you evaporate water, for instance, it's still water, right? You're not changing the molecules. It's not a chemical change. There's no chemical reaction occurring. You have the same substance as you did before, it's just in a different state. Well, there are actually five states of matter, but for livable conditions that we talk about three of them, which are solid, liquid, and gas. What is it that makes a gas compared to a liquid? What's the difference between a gas and a liquid? Everyone hear that? Right, it's a spacing issue more than anything else. First of all, it doesn't make sense to talk about a single atom being a solid, a liquid, or a gas. Those states of matter only apply to a population. You have to have several different, well, trillions and trillions of particles for it to be a gas, liquid, or solid. But you're right that a gas, in a gas, the individual particles are comparatively very far apart. That is, compared to a liquid. They're moving continuously, and they're very free to move in a gas, so they're changing positions all the time. That's also true in a liquid. They're continuously changing positions as well, but they're much closer together. And in a solid, they're still moving if they're above absolute zero, which all real things are. But they're held in place, so they're vibrating back and forth, basically. Well, because of this spacing issue, that means liquids and solids are much more dense than gases. Density is the amount of mass that's contained within a specific volume. And it's mostly space for a gas. But anyway, back to this vaporization. When evaporation occurs, it really means that for water, for instance, the water molecules are escaping the liquid phase and going into the air above it. So if we think about this same beaker of water that I drew earlier, we can imagine this evaporating as well. The reason this latent heat of vaporization is important is because, once again, just like for specific heat capacity, compared to most substances, water has a high latent heat of vaporization, meaning it takes a lot of energy to get water to evaporate. And if it does evaporate, then a lot of energy gets lost from that liquid. The result of this practically is that if water evaporates, then it is going to cool the water from which the water is evaporating into the gas phase. The liquid that's left behind that hasn't yet evaporated will be cooler and cooler the more evaporation occurs. And that's also going to cool the air. Now, that might seem counterintuitive. You might have expected that if one thing gets cooled, the other thing gets warmer. But actually, they both get cooler. And this saves your life here in Phoenix summers every day. You know, that's why we have to sweat to exist. That sweating is really just delivery of water to the surface of the skin, which then evaporates, cooling the left behind liquid, keeping your body temperature from going into lethal limits. And if you ride a bike, for instance, it doesn't have to be even a long bike ride, just a trip to a convenience store down the block, it'll seem like you're fine while you're biking, and then you get off the bike and immediately it seems like you just started sweating. Well, you've been sweating at that much the whole time, which is why you didn't die during that short trip. And that has kept you from overheating. It's just that when you get off, there's not as much wind, since you're not riding, and therefore you're not evaporating as much, and it builds up on your skin, the sweat. But it cools you. It also, though, cools the air immediately around you, which is why if you're riding a bike and you go from place that's nothing but streets and you finally hit like a golf course or something with a lot of plants, it will seem a lot cooler by that area because of the evaporation of those plants, the transpiration into the air. Yeah.
That's why it's not cool. Because my sister doesn't. That's why she has to stay in a cool place. Like, she can't go outside at all because it's too hot.
Well, there are different tolerances that people have to overheating, but in all people, they tolerate heat to as much as they do because of the fact that they sweat. And that evaporation of sweat, if that didn't occur, they would get hotter a lot sooner, is the point. But there's a range in how much people do that, like there is for any given trait. Now, why is it that evaporation can cool both the water, the liquid water, and the air above it? Well, let's look at the beaker and think about what temperature means once again. The reason, by the way, just as I've said, all these are due to, that water has a high latent heat of vaporization is because of being polar. So if you are a member of this population of water molecules, you're one of the water molecules, what is it, what do you have to do to evaporate? Well, first of all, you have to be near the surface, right? So it's only the ones at the surface. But even if you're at depth, because everything's moving around, eventually you'll make it to the surface. But let's just say you're one of the surface molecules. For you to evaporate means you're going to leave the liquid sample, the liquid population, and go off on your own, more or less, into the much more spaced out air, the gas. Well, all water molecules are the same substance, but which ones are going to be the most likely to leave, to be able to leave?
The ones that are
moving the fastest, exactly. Because to leave means you have to shoot off away from all these, right? And the faster you're traveling, the more likely it is that you'll be able to do that. Does that make sense? Well, in a non-polar sample, it will be easier because your speed can be entirely devoted to leaving. In a polar substance, you're going to be dragged behind a little bit more because of those tiny but significant hydrogen bonds. Okay, we still haven't, though, gotten to why it cools the water. If this does happen and the fastest ones in the population are leaving, then what happens to the average speed of the ones that get left behind? Well, energy, there is heat, which is the energy of the motion of the particles, but we're getting into a different topic. What I'm saying just is that if you have this sample and the fastest ones are the ones that are leaving because they're easiest to escape, it's easiest for them to escape, then they're no longer part of the population, right? They've gone off into the water vapor phase. But when the fastest ones leave, what happens to the average speed of the particles that are in the liquid? It goes lower. The average speed is now slower because you've gotten rid of the fastest ones in the class. Right? Well, what is average speed of particles? Temperature. That means the temperature has gone down by getting rid of those fastest particles. So that's why the water cools, and that's what keeps you alive. But why does the air also get cooler? Well, because a lot of these ones that are escaping are just barely escaping. So yes, they're fast enough to get out of the water population, but compared to the ones that are already in the water vapor phase, they're not actually moving as fast. So that means that adding their speed to the greater speed of the ones that are already in the gas phase is going to bring their average down too. You see that? So it cools both. And this is why an evaporative cooler, if you have one in your house, works. You continuously evaporate water, which not only cools the liquid water that's dripping down the pads, but it also cools the air, which is blown into your house, making it cooler, at least for certain months of the year. Okay, so 5, another example, shows an animal living below the surface of ice in a frozen lake. And the specialness of water here is that, unlike the vast majority of substances, the solid version of water, which is ice, is actually less dense than the liquid version. In almost all substances, it's the reverse. Gas is very low density because it's almost all space. Liquid is much higher density compared to vapor, or compared to the gas. But then density increases for almost everything when you go to liquid to solid. They get even closer together in a solid. And therefore, it's not as much space. It's denser. And if something is greater density than something else, the same amount of that, the same volume of that stuff that's more dense will be heavier, affected by gravity more because there's more mass in it. Right? And that means for the vast majority of substances, if you have a mixture of, it's all the same substance, but you have a mixture of solid chunks of that stuff in liquid of the same stuff, the solid chunks are going to drop to the bottom because they are more dense than the liquid. Clear? Well, that doesn't happen with water, right? Ice cubes float. They don't sink. Even though ice is the solid version of water in the liquid. Well, once again, this is explainable in terms of hydrogen bonding. Because of this degree of order I was talking about, because of the hydrogen bonding that's occurring, when you have a bunch of water molecules, as you see in the ice circle here, together, and if you slow them down enough, in other words, reduce the temperature enough, then they're attracted to each other all the time, regardless of temperature, because of hydrogen bonding. But when you slow them down enough, they eventually will lock into place. They'll still be vibrating, but they'll be held in position, but not very close to each other because of the angles to which they swivel in order for their negatives and positives, partial negatives and positives, to be aligned from molecule to molecule. Illustrated by these triple dots, giving it kind of a soccer ball arrangement to the crystal that forms. And there's a lot of space in the middle of each one of these soccer ball type things. All right, so that's a lower density than what's happening in liquid. In liquid, yes, there's still forces of attraction, but they're not locked into place yet. They're still moving, changing positions. So they're continuously feeling those hydrogen bonds, but they're continuously breaking them also, slipping past them, which allows them, on average, to get closer to each other. So the liquid version in this case is actually more dense. It's less space in it. Well, once again, you wouldn't exist without this fact. What this means, as far as biology is concerned, is that ice floats, and why that is important to biology is that if you consider a body of water, when the seasonal temperatures get low enough, there will be some ice formation. Some of the water molecules will freeze, right? Not all of it. So there will be both ice and water. If it were an ordinary substance, then that frozen water would sink. And therefore, you'd have a layer of ice on the bottom of the lake. That's far away from the surface, which is where the sun is hitting, where the energy is delivered when it's thawing the next time, the next season. So there would be some ice that forms when it's cold, and then when the thawing season comes around, the ice would melt, but not all of it, because it's at the bottom rather than the top. So there would still be some ice left over by the time it gets around to freezing again. And therefore, another layer would build on that, and every year it would get a little bit thicker until it was completely ice. And it's a lot more difficult for things, especially animals, to live in something that is solid rather than is liquid. All right, so in keeping in mind that water is where life started, we wouldn't exist. But it also has the advantage that floating ice, or a layer of ice at the surface, is protective. It's thermally protective because it keeps this water from getting even colder than it would. Still allows it to be liquid, though, so it can live its life in this protection until the thaw. All right, slide 6. Another important property of water is that it makes an excellent solvent. Now, speaking of solvent, there are 3 important definitions to understand what a solvent is. A solution is a particular type of mixture. There are different kinds of mixtures, but a solution is one kind of mixture. Specifically, it is a mixture in which one component of the mixture is dissolved in another component of the mixture. Okay, the overall mixture, though, is the solution. The 2 major components of the solution, though, are the solvent and the solute. The solvent in a solution is the thing that is doing the dissolving. And the solute, or there could be multiple different kinds of solutes, is the thing that is being dissolved by the solvent. And then once again, the overall combination is the whole solution. All right? Well, here we have sodium chloride, once again, table salt, being dissolved in water. We're looking at a very close up view here of just the surface of one tiny chunk of salt that's been delivered into this otherwise pure water beaker. It's an ionic compound, right, as we talked about. So it is a bunch of sodium ions and a bunch of chloride ions stuck together because they're oppositely charged. Water is polar, though, for what we've been talking about today. It's not as polar as ions because it has partial charges, whereas ions have full charges, right, one direction or the other. But because water is polar and has these partial charges, where the two meet at the surface of, at the interface between water and the outer edge of a group of salt ions, these water molecules can pick off one ion at a time, attracting that ion because of the partial positive or partial negative charges on the ends of the water molecule. So notice that this chloride ion, the big green one, which is negatively charged, it's the anion, is being surrounded, and it would be in 3 dimensions, not just in a circle here. It's completely surrounded by water molecules, but notice that those water molecules are all swiveled into a position in which their partially positive hydrogen ends are right next to the fully negative chloride, electrostatic attraction. But it surrounds them, keeping that chloride from interfering with any of the other ions. It's like a bag of water molecules around it. And similarly, the sodium ion, which is positively charged, has a bag of water around it too. But notice that the water molecules swivel so that the partially negative oxygen end, the red end, is situated next to the positive sodium ion. And so this is dissolution. The salt is being dissolved. Sodium chloride is the compound, right, when they're together. But when you put it into water, or ions in general into water, they get dissolved, and you no longer have sodium chloride, really. You have a solution that contains water as the solvent, and sodium ions in solution, and chloride ions in solution. Not sodium chloride anymore. The reason that's important is because water can do this, can dissolve a great many things. And what we call life, what I keep telling you life is, which is metabolism, which is all the chemical reactions that are occurring in the cell, not only do those occur in the cell, but they occur in solution. And more specifically, aqueous solution, which just means a solution in which the solvent is water. So life is, more specifically, aqueous solution chemistry. And without water, you can't have that situation. All right, that's enough for today.